the icon of Saint Anne. In 1677, an ancient oak was cut down in the village. Within a cavity in the stem, a late medieval miraculous image depicting the Madonna with her child and Saint Anne was uncovered. More precisely, the Mother Anne that carries her daughter Mary, on whose lap her son Jesus sits. The Holy Mother Anne was believed to be the patron of families and merchants. Most likely, this image was hidden in the tree during the time of the Reformation to protect it from iconoclasts, where it was forgotten. This icon was taken by the farmer who chopped down the oak, but because he had no use for it, it was put into the attic and was once again forgotten. One day it was found and brought downstairs, where people would do all sorts of nonsense with it. Suddenly, all windows of the home exploded simultaneously without any determinable cause. Sometime later, the brothers Johann and Dietrich, two Töden, class of wealthy merchants in northwestern Germany, were on a sales trip when they got caught in a big storm that almost capsized their ship near Holland. In desperation, they kneeled and prayed for help. Both swore to build a chapel for Saint Anne in their village if they were to be saved. And indeed, the men survived the ordeal. In 1694, soon after their happy return home, the construction of the chapel began on the exact same spot where the oak had been chopped down almost 20 years before. Many people from the surrounding area went on pilgrimages to the chapel, which became a popular sacred site. Soon, however, it became too small and was torn down. In 1728, the new chapel that still stands today was finished. Above the entrance it reads, "In 1677, an oak was felled here that revealed the current image of the Holy Saint Anne. To her honor, a chapel was erected in 1694, and this chapel replaced it in 1728. After its heyday in the 18th century, followed the decline of the Anne pilgrimages. This tradition was, however, revitalized in the middle of the 19th century. Hey everyone, welcome back to German Folk Witchery, and for today, we have a special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, of course. I'm Dish Birkenkieker, and I am a folk magic practitioner, specifically a German folk magic practitioner. I live in northwestern Germany, and I practice our localized folk magic from that part of the country, which is called Spökenkikerei, hence my name. I'm 21 years old and I study archaeology as well as cultural and social anthropology at university. So I have a lot of stuff going on, basically. I have my hands in many pots. Is that how the saying goes? I have a lot of books, basically. Yeah, I'm here to talk about a specific piece of folklore that I brought to here today about the Saint Anne statue from my village. Den Baum der Dale kriegt hebt, du hebt sie erst bi Pongs up de Hiede stellt. Du warst des mal fast am Bien Huse, wo dat Bell stöhnt. Es sie zu Recht an Tanzen hatten Horn, da hat der Ehen secht, ich will es mit dem Marient gehen für eine Hiele tanzen. Ich hatte sich herunterhalt und was der up mit der Dale herumspringt. Ob einmal fängt bi klaren Himmel an zu grummeln und blitzen und er heit slim her. Da kriegt sie doch so ein Schreck und laubt up Nähne. Sie setter bild up ein bisschen Sturm und setter Kerzen bi. Da hört dat Krummeln up. Der anderen Dach hört sie noch ein Pastor und vertellt dat Werk. Von der Tiet wird dat Bild in Ehren holen. Da passiert auch Wunder wie, wo der Baum stehen hat, ist eine Kapelle hinbaut worden. Da hängen früher immer noch viel Krücken und so wat. Jo. That is war.
Wow. Okay. So first of all, thank you. That was really cool to listen to.
That was beautiful.
Thanks.
It's really interesting because obviously me being German, I understand a few words, obviously, but it's a very, it's almost like a completely different language in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, it actually is. It's recognized by the European Charter of Minority Language as its own separate language. That has something to do with like Platt, or as it's called in Low Saxon, is way more archaic and didn't undergo some sound changes that, for example, High German went through. So in that way, Low Saxon is way more similar to English, for example, that also did not undergo some of those changes. So S in High German is often T in Low Saxon and English and stuff like that.
Oh, that is so interesting. I guess it's kind of similar to Scots in that way, because it's not, how do I put it? It's recognized as a minority language, but it's not so dissimilar that it wouldn't be entirely completely understandable by like an English person.
Also, Low Saxon has a different grammar than standard High German. In my opinion, also easier grammar than standard German, because we only have a few conjugations like first person and second person singular, and then third person singular through like third person plural. Everything is just the same conjugation usually. What I also think is interesting is that Lower Saxon is the direct descendant of Old Saxon, which is the language spoken by the Germanic tribe of the Saxons. And that's also the reason why Low Saxon today is mostly only spoken in areas which were also like inhabited by that specific Germanic tribe. So that's also an interesting part of history that kind of links us today to the ancient past.
Yeah, because it sounds really quite old, just from a completely, like, you know, not knowing this very well perspective. It sounds like something that you would have in, like, not to, you know, hopefully be offensive, but it sounds like something that you would have in, like, a TV show, for example, to be like, oh, look how old this is.
Yeah.
But yeah, it sounds really cool. And I feel like language, I mean, this is something that if you want, we can discuss a little bit on as well, because it's a topic that I feel like maybe all three of us can appreciate with the archaeology and anthropology kind of perspective of the importance of language and preserving it, and also as a gatekeeper in a way. I always feel like that's a really fascinating topic to have a look at as well. And obviously the themes of this folklore, would you call this a folklore or would you call this a story?
So the story that I brought today about the statue. Yeah, I think so. The specific stuff that I read out in Low Saxon, that's more of a retelling of events which got kind of folklorized. The English text that I gave you, that's also only incorporating a few bits of folklore combined with like actual historical data with specific years and plot points that the story kind of goes over, which is not, I guess, usual or common for folklore to have. So it's kind of a bit mixed, I would say.
Yeah, it's interesting. So this is obviously from around the 1677, right, is when it is dated to. Is that a retelling in the sense that it's an actual story, or is that more like, would you say that this has been an actual occurrence that was then retold and it became more mythological with time? Or would you say that this is recorded to be more out of the perspective of something that actually happened in that exact way?
So I guess the first one would be most accurate. Something definitely happened in 1677 and those other years that were mentioned. What exactly happened, I guess nobody knows, and that's where the folklore part comes in. I think it's pretty curious when we talk about this specific story, because these kind of historical factual things kind of blend with the folklore. I mean, I could go down the street to that chapel and see the statue that we're talking about here and look at it, and it's also very likely from that point in time that the story mentions, but everything around it is kind of more nebulous in a way. It's kind of more uncertain. It's kind of in a way similar to how you would maybe talk about relics of saints. You often have that when you go into church and they have like a finger of saint so and so, and then there's folklore attached to how that finger got there and stuff. And what wonders it could maybe bring to people who do a pilgrimage to that place. So I think it's kind of similar to that, where real historical events kind of intermix and become folklorized over time. Or maybe I'm just wrong and actually the windows all exploded when that person tried to dance with the statue.
We definitely have that with folklore in general, I feel like, where it's kind of that combination of myth and something that probably did happen and that became more fantastical over time. You know, how we have just stories with, of course, several translations and several generations. It's like in German, what is it? The secret post, and you whisper into each other's ear. It's kind of like that, right? Like we see that a lot of times with folklore as well, where over the years it just adapts and changes and evolves, I would dare say. But it's really fascinating that that statue is in the region of where you live and everything. So it's a very localized story. Do you think that that story is quite prominent in your culture?
Yeah, I would say we have a lot of folklore which is kind of in a similar vein, that also teeters the line between actual historical events and folklore in the more commonly used sense. We have, especially here in northwestern Germany, where the land is pretty low-lying and we are constantly like bombarded with winds from the North Sea, so everything's pretty wet and damp all the time. And we have a lot of marshlands and swamps because of that, and the ground is kind of unsteady. We have a lot of folklore about things going missing in the bogs, in the swamps. And of course, this is an actual real-life thing that happened just over time. These kind of forces of nature were personified as specific beings which would pull people into the bogs, into the wetlands, and like murder them or something else. And I think, and this is kind of a theme which connects folklore not just to the culture, but also to the landscape that culture inhabits.
So the piece of folklore or story that you brought today, we have a couple of major themes in here. If you want, you can just outline them for us if you'd like.
Yeah. So in this folklore, we basically have the same themes that we also see in a lot of other German folklore that tell people what to do and what not to do. In this case, specifically, it's paying respect to the divine, especially, and trusting in the divine. And what I also find interesting is that here we can kind of see, if we look closely, some pagan and Christian elements overlapping, at least in my opinion, because we see the importance of trees and, let's be honest, taking a statue, basically an idol, out of a tree. It's kind of, it raises an eyebrow.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with how the way that you treat said idol can have very, very real impacts on your environment around you. That's very, very pagan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And we also have, which I'm going to talk about a bit later, some other traditions and festivities attached to this statue, which are also kind of pagan-esque. And this statue is very important, basically, for my village, which is why I chose this piece of folklore, because we have the stories that tell basically the origin story of this statue, and then we have the traditions and celebrations and rituals which are attached to it and still practiced nowadays, and are of huge importance not just to my village but also our surrounding region. And this is kind of, I don't know, my anthropology senses constantly tingle when I think about the story, because this is, I think, so interesting that a community kind of develops this origin story for their traditions, basically in a similar vein to maybe how we nowadays kind of think of superheroes as having a specific origin story and then having them acting in the present as sort of guiding figures.
Exactly. Something that I have kind of noticed with this is the cutting down of an oak tree. And obviously we see that being a very important element in pagan / Christian history, with the cutting down of the ancient sacred trees. And it's really interesting that then a Christian figure comes out of that pagan, potentially, let's say, tree. But at the same time, we have a little bit of that paganism preserved forever in that statue, just because that statue is made out of that tree. So it's kind of going to live on, but in new ways.
Some time ago, I did some research into the oak tree in German folk magic beliefs, and it's still a very sacred tree. There's a lot of folklore attached to it, and especially folklore specifically stating that you should not cut down an oak tree, because then terrible things could start happening to you. So in a way, the cutting down of this oak tree could have been kind of viewed as sort of sacrilege in a way. And for this kind of damaging and attack on the land and its animacy in a way, its personhood, for this event to then be kind of turned into the central pillar and core of this story, which is very animistic in a way, very animated, very spiritual, and not just in a Christian way. I think that's very interesting and a very interesting dichotomy. And from my research into the oak trees, I also found out that the story of my village is not necessarily the only one of its kind. It seems that getting statues out of chopped down trees, especially oak trees, seems to be kind of a theme in Germany.
Yeah, I think it's a very fascinating road to go down into. You can really get a lot of symbolism out of, and you can really philosophize about that too, I think. Especially because Anne is also then known as like protectress of families and merchants, correct?
Yeah, and for my village especially, that would have been really important because we had the Tönn here, which are a merchant class from northwestern Germany that traded all throughout basically northern Europe. They went over to the Netherlands, they went to southern Scandinavia, they took over the seas to England, and also their trade routes connected over the Baltics to Riga and even St. Petersburg. Yeah, so this kind of very extensive and important trade network would have really benefited from such a protectress. So I don't think that it is a coincidence that this statue popped up here.
I was actually doing a little bit of research previous to this about like biblical meanings, particularly for oak trees. And one that kept coming up was fertility, as well as stability and strength and protection being part of the oak tree symbolism. And I find that so intriguing in relation to this story, because of course, St. Anne is also, you know, in the kind of more Christian traditional sense, known as the grandmother of Jesus, right? And so there's something really interesting about those two things being combined, you know, this icon of St. Anne being held in a tree that represents fertility as well.
Yeah, and especially when we go to the fertility aspect that you mentioned, this is actually still a central theme in the rituals that we have on St. Anne, basically. So every Sunday after the Assumption of Mary, which is, I think, the 15th of August, we have this like entire week dedicated to St. Anne and this statue. And we take this statue out of the chapel and then have a procession which goes all around the village and through the fields. And my grandmother told me that back in the day, the procession would actually go over the fields. And this kind of invokes a specific theme of blessing the land and the community with fertility when you go over the fields, especially. And I think that's really reminiscent of some accounts that we have of Germanic pagans. So, for example, we have in the Germania, which is a book written by the Roman historian Tacitus or Tacitus. Mm. There he speaks of the procession of the pagan goddess Nerthus. And I actually have the quote here where he mentions that goddess, and I'm just going to quickly read it out. "None of these tribes have any noteworthy feature except their common worship of Ertha, the Mother Earth, and their belief that she interposes in human affairs and visits the nations in her car," or chariot in this case. "In an island of the ocean, there is a sacred grove, and within it is a consecrated chariot covered over with a garment. Only one priest is permitted to touch it." And then we also have another mention of a similar ritual in the Norse Fletcher book, I think it's called, where such a procession is mentioned for the god Freyr, where an idol of him is carried in a chariot over the fields to kind of bless them. And this modern day St. Anne procession, which has gone on for centuries here, in its core theme really reminds me of that. So in my mind, I'm thinking to myself, is this maybe some sort of pagan synchronization that happened? Did people here around this part of the world have such a tradition of blessing the field and then just changed the pagan goddess that they worshipped in for the new Christian Saint Anne and interposed some of their pagan motives on it?
Yeah, I feel like that's one of those theories that I would have for sure. I remember reading that part from Germania as well, because I was obviously doing research in my own practice with Frau Holle or Holda, and Nerithos is sometimes equated to that, especially because you've got similar themes, and then obviously you've got the grandmother element with Saint Anne. I feel like there's a couple of those symbolisms that you can be like, you know that meme where it's the guy with the map and the like all the strings connecting to each other?
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of times that's the case when we do research, isn't it? Yeah, I feel like there is a lot of these elements, the animism, you've got the grandmother theme, you've got the chariot, you've got the bog theme with that goddess is supposed to be. I think it was on an island, and I remember specifically reading also that there was human sacrifice specifically in this case as well.
Yeah, according to Tacitus, at least. I mean, yeah. He was a Roman, so we don't know exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Always have to take it with a big pinch of salt.
That's so interesting, especially just relating back to what you said earlier, Ella, about the concept of the oak tree and the statue growing together, representing paganism and Christianity kind of intertwining and growing together and evolving into something, I suppose, new, but also something, I wish there was a word to describe what I meant, something that could kind of exist at the same time, I guess, similar to dichotomy.
Yeah, that's what you were also mentioning, right? With kind of the moving from pagan to Christian, and it's obviously a theme that we see a lot of times with a lot of these stories. And that's why I think a lot of people are so interested nowadays in folklore, because it's kind of like, it's a wave to the past, but already being like, it's a wave to the past, but also to the future, let's say.
Yeah, I can see that.
I guess it kind of builds off of what we were talking about last week, when we were kind of having this debate and discussion about whether, I don't know, like the preservation of pagan folktales with a Christian perspective, is it morally wrong? Can you put morals onto something like that? It kind of just goes to show that it may not be as simple as we want it to be. I guess culture never is very simple, right? There's always some kind of dichotomy going on. So like things have to, the past has to exist with the present in some kind of way. And we can see that here. There's not so much of like this dark tension that we think there must be sometimes today, or we presume there would be between the Christian and pagan elements.
I also wanted to mention before I forget, because Neve already talked about the fertility aspects of celebration of Saint Anne in the Bible, and then I talked about the fields and stuff. There's also a focus on human fertility during this celebration, because it is said that young women who wanted or, well, were expected to marry in the near future, it was said that they should pray to Saint Anne for a husband and then do this procession in August in her honor. And they would sing a specific song in Low Saxon, which would kind of also invoke Saint Anne giving them a husband. So the important part of the song, it goes like, O Mora Anne, Dominen Mann, and that means, oh, Mother Anne, give me a husband. And I think that's also really interesting that Saint Anne is invoked in this specific way. I mean, someone who is maybe very Protestant would have a heart attack that a person would invoke a saint over God himself. Also, my village is like one of the only few parts of northwestern Germany that's actually Catholic and not Protestant. So there's always a bit of side-eyeing going on between the villages here.
In the city that I live in, Glasgow, we have a massive issue with sectarianism between Catholics and Protestants. So whenever I hear that there's any kind of like side-eye between Catholics and Protestants, I'm like, oh, I feel like home. Other people get it.
Yeah, especially in rural communities, it could be get really ugly from time to time. My grandparents also like weren't allowed to play with the Protestant children growing up, and luckily things have changed and everyone is pretty chill these days. But it was a big issue for a long time.
Yeah, my grandparents as well. My Oma is Catholic because she's from Bavaria. She's from the Munich region. But then my Opa was born in Berlin. And so he's Protestant. And I know that there was a couple of, because they met when they were like 14. And I know that there was some drama around that, or not drama, but like, let's say side-eyeing around that too. But it's a common theme that I think you see in Germany, especially. You've got the Catholic, especially in the south, of course, in Bavaria, and then you've got the more Protestant in the north. So why would you, if you had to like pinpoint why you think you've got that village being more Catholic versus the rest of that area is Protestant, is that something that you have thoughts on?
I'm really kind of, first of all, curious on how that even happened. I mean, the west of my region is Catholic and the East is more Protestant. I don't know how this happened that one village a few kilometers over has a different denomination of Christianity. I'm curious to see what that even is about. But I don't think that impacts the folk culture here all that much. I've researched, of course, the folklore of my entire region, and what I can see that, of course, in the Catholic parts, we have more folklore when it comes to saints and specific stuff like that. But even the Protestant part of my region is still very like drenched in folk magic and folk beliefs and rural traditions. Like in the Protestant part, they still go out on, I think, Easter morning to a specific well and fetch water because it is believed that this water is supposed to carry healing abilities. I think the Catholic parts also had a well where they would do the exact same thing. So in that regard, I don't think it impacts my region that much besides like the more overlying beef between Catholics and Protestants.
Yeah. It's really interesting that you mentioned the healing well, because we were having that obviously discussion in the last episode. Wells are super relevant in German folklore.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you kind of seem to, from an outsider's perspective especially, there seems to be these recurring, I suppose from an animistic perspective, characters. Otherwise, it might be strange to refer to wells or oak trees as characters, but I think from that very animistic perspective, you certainly could.
Yeah, I feel like one thing that I wanted to ask you, because going back to the fertility especially, it's interesting that, so the fertility ritual, is that the one in August?
Yes.
That's interesting considering usually, obviously, springtime is associated more with fertility. And is that then also the, I think it was your account actually, is that the one where you create the bundle with the gathering of the seven different herbs? Is that also that same festival then or ritual, let's say?
Yes, exactly. So this entire period is very magically charged in my village and surrounding villages. When it comes to the fertility thing, I think it has more something to do with the Assumption of Mary, because that's, of course, the date where this celebration is calibrated after. So the Sunday after the Assumption of Mary is when this entire week of Anne celebration starts. And of course, Anne and Mary are very connected. And these are like very powerful female figures, which also in rural communities have arguably some pagan synchronization going on. So laying these two celebrations close to each other would have probably made a lot of sense. And also when this Anne celebration takes place and her statue is carried over the fields and through the village, this is usually the time when the rye harvest already happened, which happens usually in early August or late July. So you could kind of view this through the lens of kind of re-energizing the fields after the harvest for the following year in that way. And also when it comes to the herbs that are gathered, they are gathered on the Thursday morning before the Assumption of Mary, before the sun rises. And there are seven herbs, seven pretty specific herbs. And there are also, like, in a village over, they gather like 15, I believe. I usually just gather seven, and not those seven which are stated that should be gathered, because I don't have access to all of that, and I don't feel like traveling hours through my village looking for these herbs. So I just hop into my garden on Thursday morning and kind of gather that stuff that which grows there, which has worked out fine for me these past couple of years. But this just goes to show that the Assumption of Mary, that this date is also used for this other holiday, this other tradition of gathering the herbs. So this is a really central celebration, which all of these other traditions align themselves around.
Yeah, and so that gathering of the seven different herbs, what, if I may ask, just for someone who's like completely unaware of this, what would you then do with those herbs?
So the tradition states that you should make that bundle and hang it up to dry, and then hang it in your attic, and it would kind of act as a talisman and protect your house from all sorts of trouble, but mainly thunder and lightning. Which is, of course, something that people in the past would have worried about quite a lot more than we today. So what I do is I gather that bundle, hang it up, dry it, and then usually around the time of the Rauhnächte, which start at Christmas and go on until the Epiphany, 6th of January, at this time I will take that bundle out again, crush it all up, and then use it as incense to kind of smoke out all negative entities and bad spirits, and kind of create a protective layer around my home.
Oh, I love that. I love the, you know, incorporating that down into Rauhnächte. That's a really interesting one. I love that. I might be a little bit inspired by that, actually. And so I also find it interesting that it's a protection from thunder. Obviously, that's something, I'm not sure, Neve, if you know this, in Germany, one of the very common ones that people would always protect themselves from is thunder and lightning. But it's interesting that it's gathered on a Thursday. Is that, does that, do you think, have to do with the thunder element?
Yes. So there is this theory. I don't know who was the first one who proposed it, but I can just point to the Danish historian of religion, Rune Jan Rasmussen. He talked about it in one of his videos, I think. He's a historian of religion, I think I said that. And he said that Thursdays specifically were always kind of magically charged, and he associated that, in the case of Scandinavia, of course, with Thor, and in our region it would be like Thunir and Dona. And this deity, of course, has his hammer, which would not just like battle giants and stuff, but also would be used to bless things and to kind of make them whole and better, and just make them to be under his protection. So Rune Jan Rasmussen proposed that any magical activity which were practiced on a Thursday would automatically have the protection of Dona resting on them. It would be kind of easier to invoke this deity's blessing for this magical working. So I think especially in the connection of protection from thunder, it would make sense that you would gather the herbs which would protect you from that on a Thursday, to kind of have this additional layer of blessing from the thunder deity himself. Yeah, so that's basically what I think is most likely to happen here. But also Thursdays are not just used for protection from thunder and weather magic in general. sometimes Thursdays were just dates where you would maybe feed your house spirits and stuff. So any magical activity on a Thursday would kind of be blessed with this extra oomph, kind of.
It's a very thorough process.
It definitely sounds like it. Like, you've got the assumption of Mary already being that of blessing and protecting a field, and then you've got the gathering of the herbs done on a Thursday to once again have the blessing and protection element. Like, you've got all of these, and then of course your own home to be blessed and protected from thunder, which again, you've got again that like network of different elements tying in together really, really well. It's really fascinating how intrinsically and well thought out this seems to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think a lot of folk magic is just the layering of specific traditions to create an effect.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's making me think about something, again, we spoke about in the last episode is, I suppose, the accessibility of folk magic. Now, that's a very vague and broad term, but to kind of go into it more deeper, we were speaking about how, as folklore generally, especially from very specific parts of Europe, is becoming more popular among online communities from people all over the world. There's a lot of talk about making these kind of stories accessible. However, from someone who is in archaeology and someone who studied the classics, and I imagine you will both have your own thoughts and ideas about this particular subject because of your own backgrounds as well, I am curious and questioning as to how accessible folklore can be. And I think if we begin to, for lack of a better word, simplify it to be more accessible to wider communities, you lose that nuance and that very specific thoroughness that you can see as you've just described there. And I'm also curious about the language aspect. You read it from a very specific minority language, and I imagine that there is quite a lot that gets lost even in just the rhythm and the tone of which the piece is delivered when you translate it to English. I'm just curious as to what your thoughts on that kind of topic are.
When we adapt folk traditions for our modern day, it's not necessarily dumbing it down, because what the people in the past did with these traditions is make them very accessible to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And when we nowadays look for inspiration into those traditions, I think it's only right and only in the vein of folk magic to make these things more accessible to us. I don't think that you could maybe make a case of dumbing things down or making things lose value or appropriating them from people who are long dead or whatever. The core tenet of folk magic, in my opinion, has always been that it is accessible and adaptable. And when we take these folk traditions, which are very specific to the time and place in which they were practiced, and then try to kind of retrieve them. Yes, we should do it in a meaningful way. And yes, we should stay true to the core tenets and purposes of this. But changing things here and there to make them more adaptable to us, I think is only the right thing to do. For example, I already told you that the herbs that I gather on the Thursday before the Assumption of Mary aren't the specific herbs which were traditionally gathered, because they're not very accessible to me. I just use the herbs that I have already growing in my garden. And the effect of these herbs, the effect of this tradition, is still the same. It's just more adapted to me. And for a second point on the language, yes, I really think that if you were to talk about this stuff, to rediscover this folklore and retell it maybe in German or in English, of course you're going to lose nuances and specific characteristics. I think on the one hand, it's important that these stories survive. And with the way that the minority language is going right now, I don't know how long these old stories would survive in their original language. So on the one hand, I'm happy that these things get translated, that these things are practiced by people who aren't maybe speakers of this or any other minority language. But it kind of also pains me, because there are just some things in the cadence and the vocabulary and the sounds of Low Saxon that you just cannot replicate in any other language. And speaking this language has also kind of its own mindset, I feel like.
Yes, on one hand, it's more of an evolution rather than a reduction in your eyes. But at the same time, when it comes to the language, like there are certainly like characteristics of the story that kind of get lost through translation.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to summarize that.
I feel like that's kind of similar, not to constantly pull back to the last episode, but we obviously were talking in the last one about, you know, the Grimm brothers, and it's better that they did preserve, even if it's not really like 100% the same anymore, you know, like one of those. And I feel like that is kind of something that maybe could be applied here too, where it's like, it's better that we are able to preserve them, even if we need to have them translated, because at least we have them preserved in some form, right?
Yeah, this thing with the Low Saxon kind of being in a curious place and stories not being preserved, for example. This is a feature that's not just unique to Germany. We have, of course, Low Saxons, because also in the Netherlands, they face the exact same problems, remarkably similar with just Dutch being pushed instead of Low Saxon. Mm-hmm. We have another minority language which exists in both in both countries, which would be Frisian. And that's kind of more so recognized, but it's not out of like the danger zone of dying out by any means. It holds a bit more prestige, but a lot of people also don't take that language seriously anymore. And if we look at, for example, the Sorbian language in Eastern Germany, which is a Slavic language, it faces the exact same problem. And we could go many different European countries which have similar problems. I think it's just that the traditions which were central to the speakers of this language or these languages kind of die with that language in a way. We then have the exact same issue of preservation, but at what cost?
I feel like, Niamh, we talked about this, I think, in private about Scots, right?
Scots is a very interesting minority language, especially when you relate it to Scottish Gaelic. People, very understandably, can be very quick to emotion when this conversation comes up. Because I remember I replied to someone on TikTok who'd asked, I think, is Scots a language or something like that? And I'd said, yeah, it's technically recognized as a language. And I said, from my own personal perspective, like I usually just see it as more of a dialect. And I went on to say something, something, something. Most Scottish people won't be able to actually speak Scots, but there will be quite significant amounts of words in their vocabulary that are Scots. But, you know, it's not necessarily like we're speaking in full sentences. That got a lot of interesting feedback, I guess, because we're talking about like the technicality of the language there. But now more and more Scots and Scottish Gaelic are being celebrated in Scotland. So it's a really, I guess, difficult line to walk when it comes to these minority languages. As you say, preservation at what cost? I think what's working over here is celebration as much as possible, whether it's, for example, we're now doing Gaelic film awards, so like short films that are made in Gaelic, or other pieces of media that are written in Gaelic, for example, are being celebrated in that way. And that kind of seems to be putting the languages back on the map, so to speak. But there's still so much that's lost, you know.
I wish we had that same kind of enthusiasm in Northern Germany, because for the most part, we don't even have a standardized writing system for Low Saxon.
Oh.
Because we have so many different dialects of Low Saxon. Like 5 main dialects, and then many other dialects which can be sorted into like the family of one of those 5 dialects. And of course, when you try to write in your specific version of Low Saxon, you're going to write phonetically how you say it. And someone from another part of a Low Saxon speaking region in Germany might look at that and go like, what the fuck are you talking about?
I know this is the same with Bavaria as well.
Yeah. And this problem is even exacerbated by the fact that Low Saxon is also spoken in the Netherlands, and their people, of course, are going to base their writing system on Dutch, which makes communication even harder. There has, in recent times, there has been an attempt to kind of standardize Low Saxon writing system, so it's not phonetic anymore for each dialect, but it's written in a way where everyone can kind of get the gist of what's being said. This is also the writing system which I kind of try to use, but this was not done by the state or anything. This was done by people in the language community. This was done by the speakers of that language community, which is nice and all, but I think without like more state intervention, the language is going to be in serious trouble, and in that turn also the culture is going to be in serious trouble. I don't think that the burden of preserving this minority language should primarily be placed on the speakers of that language, because most of them are pretty old. I'm willing to say that I'm the only one under the age of 40 in my village who speaks that language sufficiently. Wow. And you know, it's kind of bleak in that way. And I feel like it should be more celebrated. It should be more eagerness behind preserving this language and the culture that's connected to that.
Is there any like societal, maybe negative or less positive associations with speaking that language?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So basically, no matter if you go into Northern Germany, Eastern Netherlands or Southern Denmark, the sentiment is always that people who speak Low Saxon are too stupid to understand the standard language. Oh, it's the language of the stupid farmers, the stupid farm folk, the stupid northerners. And it's a crude way of speaking. And some people will even think it's rude to speak in Low Saxon.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so over the years, many Low Saxon speakers stopped teaching their children Low Saxon or stopped speaking Low Saxon to their children to give them better opportunities, so to say, on the job market. Because if you don't speak Low Saxon and if you aren't associated with that rural kind of culture, you were more likely to get hired. And the argument usually went like, oh, these children shouldn't learn Low Saxon anymore. It's too crude. Better teach them English or Spanish or Russian or something like that. And then they will have better opportunities. So it's kind of, stigmatized in a way. And I think in that same vein, also a lot of other parts of rural folk culture can be stigmatized as well, especially if these traditions can't be capitalized on, if they can't be made into like big celebrations which attract a lot of visitors who pay for stuff like that. I think, Ella, of course, you will probably recognize the things with the Krampuslauf in Bavaria, which has been kind of hyped up to this big celebrations where a lot of people go there and spend their money, and it's kind of been integrated into like this very capitalistic system, which kind of separates the intention of that celebration from the actual reality of it.
Yeah.
And if your tradition can't be capitalized in a similar way, if it is more private, if it is less of a spectacle, things tend to go down. And it certainly doesn't help if the language in which these traditions are being like undertaken is also kind of dying out.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to have a look at, for example, Bavaria, I mean, the biggest one that everyone, I think, will know is Oktoberfest. And it's so funny because we specifically did not go to Munich last Oktoberfest because we were like, no, the beer is like 16 euros. So we went to our local one, and our village is, or not village, but small town, and the beer was still 12 euros.
Oh my God.
And it's just, it's crazy, the consumerism and how much like it's being marketed, and it's being marketed to be this like tourist event, and you really do lose the sense and the meaning behind a lot of this. So is, for example, the Assumption of Mary, is that quite specific to your village, or is that bigger as well, or is it becoming bigger, for example?
So I think the Assumption of Mary is pretty big in a lot of other places here. Here, what's the main event basically is the Anne week, or the week of Anne, which happens after the Assumption. Because that's, of course, the big like tourist attraction. A lot of people from this region, from the surrounding villages, all do a pilgrimage here with this procession. They book hotels, they go into like the pubs here, they spend their money, and so this thing has been kind of boasted up. And the Assumption of Mary, which doesn't have like a procession or things which are easily capitalized on, it's kind of almost non-existent here. Some people still go to church on that day, and maybe a special sermon is going to be held. But other than that, even though it's the central pillar on which all of these other celebrations are oriented around, the Assumption of Mary really doesn't play a big role in my village anymore.
It's like a double-edged sword, you know, like on the one hand, if these celebrations bring people to the region and they do spend money in that community, like it could be seen as a good thing for the community. But there comes a point where you're really pushing that boundary and you're starting to lose the significance of things like, for example, you know, the meaning behind it, really, right? Like, oh gosh, how do you balance that, right? And so another question I had, especially because we were talking about more like, oh, the stupid farmers, you know, do you think that these traditions of, for example, the gathering of the herbs, or even walking over the fields or near the fields with the statue, has that got stigma around it?
So my gut instinct is to say no, because basically no one does it anymore. So if I were to like go over to my neighbors, which are maybe a bit younger, and ask them, oh, do you gather herbs on the Thursday before the Assumption of Mary? They would think, what are you talking about? And maybe the very, very old people in the farmsteads, they might still remember some of their like older relatives doing that. But these kinds of traditions have been more and more so dying out and disappearing. And the only way that I found out about this specific tradition of gathering herbs is because I actively read up on stuff like this. I went out of my way to kind of gather books and old accounts of the traditions of my region. And this is where I found this tradition being mentioned. And I asked my grandparents about it, if they knew of that tradition. And they knew that some people gathered herbs, but they did not know about that specific tradition, which might say that this tradition wasn't very widespread around here to begin with. But I think it has more something to do with my grandmother not being from here, and also the family of my grandfather not being from here. So not that big of a stigma, I would say. Maybe if I were to actually go out on that day and gather herbs from the village, and not just out of my garden, and someone would notice me like walking their dog, they would maybe think, what is this weird person doing before sunrise outside on the fields gathering some weird flowers? That might be the extent of the stigma which comes to that.
Okay. I can imagine. I can like see that in my mind's eye, you know.
Yeah, so, witchy problems.
Yeah, exactly. So I've seen, and correct me if I'm wrong, I've seen you like write down plat as well, right? So are you, for example, in the process of collecting these old stories and also the language, for example? Like, are you, for example, let's say, doing the work of preserving a lot of these things?
Well, I try to. I have a Word document where I wrote down some vocabulary in my specific dialect of Platt or Low Saxon. But that's just for myself as of now. And I gather that vocabulary mainly not through my own knowledge, but through looking through different texts written in Platt, mm-hmm. and looking at the vocabulary there and then writing that down with a translation. I also have gathered a lot of books, old resources from my region, which are either entirely in Platt Low Saxon or partly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how I would maybe properly distribute that information. I mean, I could tell people what's in the stories. I'm kind of doing that right now, but mm-hmm. I don't know if I can like scan everything and put it online, because I don't know the legality of that. But I'm trying to make at least Low Saxon more visible, because even if I don't exactly put these stories scanned up on the internet, I can still talk about Low Saxon. I can still talk about how my folk practice is so intimately connected to that culture and language. I can write Low Saxon in tweets in my Instagram story. I can just make people more aware, not maybe that there's this entire minority language with that big of a history, but maybe just kind of make them realize, oh, this is a weird language. That's not quite German. I wonder what that is. And maybe get the curiosity going and then maybe lead them to doing their own research, for example, their own quick Googling. And so I'm trying to kind of, through my content, make the culture and language a bit more visible.
I actually wonder if you, I'm not sure if you've, to overstep or anything, I hope, but I almost wonder if that is something that you could bring towards your professors, for example, or if your university would have any interest in doing something like that, considering you are in the field of archaeology and anthropology. Because I feel like that, to me at least, having done my bachelor in anthropology, that would be something that, if I was a professor, would be very interested in.
Yeah, the thing is, most of my professors aren't from here. They're usually from southwestern Germany. So they have basically no interest in Low Saxon. They get really antsy when I mention that because they absolutely can't understand it and basically want nothing to do with that. There is, from my university, at least there was a kind of sort of organization or department which centered around Low Saxon, but I feel like they've been inactive for like about 4 years now, maybe. So I guess that one went down the tubes. So I think the best route, as I see it now, for me to go is just by myself, which is kind of sad, but you know, whatever. But I also found it interesting to connect to other people who maybe speak Low Saxon or any other minority language and talk about our shared experiences, because at the end of the day, we're kind of fighting a similar struggle.
As you say, through sharing your content, it's going to pique the curiosity of many people. And even if, you know, walking away from looking at your content online or listening to this episode or something like that, someone knows even just like a tidbit of information about your culture, I think that's doing a lot.
The thing is, Low Saxon isn't, and Northwestern or Northern German culture isn't my only like burden, to say it like that, my only thing that I feel like deserves preservation. I already mentioned that a large chunk of my ancestry comes from Silesia, which is today a region in Central Europe. Most of it is in southwestern Poland nowadays. And there are, of course, many different languages and dialects which were spoken in Silesia. Many were more Slavic influenced, many were more German influenced, and many of them have already died out or are in the process of dying out as a result of the ethnic cleansing which took place in Silesia after World War II, but also through, I may be going to get hateful comments for this, but also through pretty shit preservation methods used by the Polish government. They are especially, it doesn't matter if it's a more Slavic or more German Silesian dialect, it basically gets kind of ignored and in some accounts even systematically defunded by the government, which doesn't help the community at all. And of course, in Germany, I did research on this at university. People who were first to come here after the ethnic cleansing, they quickly stopped talking in their Silesian dialect because they were being discriminated against. Even here in the Low Saxon regions, Silesian speakers were also discriminated against, which is funny because you guys, you both speak minority language. Like, why not just be friends? But whatever. And so I basically speak zero to none of my family's specific Silesian dialect, which was called Powash. And mm-hmm. I have a, I'm fortunate enough to have a dictionary. That's what it's called, a dictionary for Powash. But you can go only so far with that. And so if you think things look bleak for Low Saxon, you don't even know about Silesian because it's so much worse.
My goodness.
Yeah, my great-grandfather is Silesian.
Oh, cool.
And yeah, I have to do a lot more research into that. I don't know a lot about that part of my family yet. I'm still in the midst of like trying to talk to my opa. I'm like, so, your dad. Yeah, I only know like a little bit about that, but it's a really, really interesting situation. It's an unfortunate situation, of course, to a degree as well, or a big degree, of course, as well. Especially if you then don't have the help of a government. And obviously, you know, it's interesting when governments don't want to help with preservation of culture. It's kind of like, but why not? You know?
Yeah, I think France also has a big problem with that. As far as I'm aware, France doesn't recognize any minority language, which, of course, is bad for the dialects of French spoken there, but also like Basque, which is spoken mm-hmm. in southwestern France, and Brythonic, I think it's called, the Celtic language, which is spoken in France. They also have a pretty tough time. And of course, as I said, these things can be found in some shape or form in basically every European country. So, of course, Neve has in Scotland the thing with Scots and Scottish Gaelic. Norway, Sweden, Finland don't really do a whole lot. Well, they do more than the German government does with Low Saxon, but they not giving their best, let's say, with the Sami languages. The Russian Federation has a huge problem with preserving minority languages, and yeah, it's bleak.
It is, yeah. I mean, it is then nice to see when communities do come together and do celebrate certain things, or they do honor certain traditions. It's like, oh, a glimmer of hope.
We do have these kind of small gatherings of people who speak Low Saxon, where just Low Saxon is being spoken. Sometimes there's Low Saxon theater. Sometimes there are Low Saxon stories being read out loud. But these events are not usually for me because they are mainly visited by old people, and they tend to be more on the conservative side and conservative leading, and that's not my crowd. Which is another thing, these kind of rural folk culture things were kind of inaccessible to me because I never really had that kind of community here. I wasn't really accepted into the community, partly, I believe, because of Silesian family history, but also because I'm queer and I was quite visibly an outcast even as a child. So these things weren't really accessible to me, and studying them now and partly being even more knowledgeable than the people who were in those communities kind of is my cheeky way of reclaiming that, because I feel like I have a right to those traditions as well.
Yeah, of course, of course.
I love that. I love that little cheeky moment for you there. Good for you. Yeah, it's really unfortunate when you've got that community and you want to preserve it, and then the actual community is like, no. Communities sometimes, they, I feel like, need a little bit of a push at certain times. Obviously, it's not necessarily your responsibility to do something like that, because that's a lot of effort and mental effort as well. But I sometimes wonder if, who knows, maybe in 50 or 70 years, people will regard you as like a very important figure in preserving something like this, for example.
Would be nice, but it would be kind of a middle finger to those bigoted people of my village. If I were to become the person which were to preserve our culture, that would be very funny. Before I also forget that, circling all the way back to Saint Anne and her statue, I still have one more point on my outline that I did not mention. The last part of the story, which I read in Low Saxon, the person talking in that story says that in the past there were a lot of crutches hanging in that chapel. And this is connected to votive offerings which were given to Saint Anne. A lot of times, of course, people would do a pilgrimage to that chapel, Anne week or not, and they would pray to Saint Anne in front of the statue and give some sort of offering which was connected to the, for example, ailments that were, that they were seeking a cure for. So people would maybe leave their crutches there. Or I think I sent this picture to Ella already, with the vitrine?
The glass housing where you put things in. What is it called? You know how, like, for example, in I think it's the Vatican, they have like the glass thingy and you have on display like the bones and stuff, like, what's that called? Hold on, vitrine. Let me quickly Google Translate.
Okay. So in the meantime, I will talk about whatever is in the vitrine, which would be some other votive offerings. Which in the picture that I sent you, there were a lot of gold pendants and golden jewelry, which was given to Saint Anne as an offering to make her pay attention to you more and kind of persuade her to cure you of the ailment. And there are actually accounts of a man called Heinrich Hamm, which in 1751 went to that chapel and asked Anne to cure him of a, it was probably a disease which rid his legs to be immobile, and he asked Anne to cure that. And in that tale, it says that the first time he asked that, he went up and walked through the village to a specific farm. And then the second time when he came, he did the same and then walked a bit further out of the village. And then after a while, he completely regained mobility in his legs. And that's like a wonder attached to Saint Anne.
Oh, I see. I see. Okay.
Sorry? Another layer attached to her, not just fertility, but also healing.
Healing.
So that's it is called a glass showcase. That's really interesting that you've got that healing aspect as well. I mean, a lot of saints, of course, have those wonders and especially healing attached to them, especially then with water and things like that. But it's really interesting that you still have a lot of times that you would light a candle in a lot of chapels. But with this one specifically, the leaving of crutches or jewelry kind of to be like appeasing that saint, it's very, very, if I may say so, it sounds very pagan.
It is, actually. So as far as I know, that tradition originated in ancient Rome. It might be a bit older, I don't know. But in it's an old document called the Indicolus, which is a manuscript from the time that the tribe of the Saxons, the tribe that lived here, was being Christianized. That document is written by monks who were basically writing a how-to guide or a what-to-expect guide for other missionaries which were trying to convert the pagans here. And in that document, they mention that it should be not allowed for the people to leave specific formed offerings at the graves of their ancestors or the local churches to seek healing. Mm. And the person which went over that document and kind of analyzed it said that this is most likely also connected to those votive offerings. So it may be that the Roman tradition carried over to the Germanic tribes, or this Germanic tribe in particular. And that makes it all the more interesting that still a couple of centuries back, people were leaving these votive offerings at the statue of Saint Mary, Saint Anne here.
So completely off topic. I love that sometimes we have a lot of source material from Christians being like, do not do this. And then they detail how not to do that thing. yeah, that really does sound very intriguing. And it's really interesting, especially that it's specifically crutches or things that were representative of those ailments that they were trying to cure, that that is exactly what they would leave. That you've got that kind of symbolic, here's the thing I want to remove myself from, and that that was kind of used as a votive offering.
Yeah. It's a very grand gesture of trust as well. I imagine it's probably not the crutches that they would actually have to walk away from the icon from, but you know,
yeah,
it's like, I will leave my crutches here and I will walk out of this building and I will therefore be cured, you know?
Yeah, I think in a lot of cases, it was the way that you described, but also people would leave their crutches afterhand, after they were cured, as kind of both as an offering and also kind of to show gratitude and to show everyone, this saint cured me. Here is the evidence. But also, I believe that Austria and probably also Bavaria, they did similar things.
So I'm not super well versed on that sort of realm, but I've heard of things similar because I did obviously have a lot of Christian family or Catholic family as well. And you do see kind of like those votive offerings and things like that still very much prominent. I know that in, for example, the countryside, what you see a lot of times is it's more so Jesus figures. And then they are kind of in like a little wooden, like not a house, but like a very tiny little wooden like roofing over the Jesus figure. And then a lot of times you would have things lying there. And obviously those would have been offerings, and they would have oftentimes been by the community, the local community, requesting things, let's say.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We have that also in the exact same way, I believe here. We have, I think in English it's called a wayward shrine. I think the German word would be Opferstock. What I think is interesting is that we have these wayward shrines not just for like Jesus or Mary or any other saints, but also specific folk saints which aren't canonized by the church as such. So you could argue that the church might raise an eyebrow at how we do the Saint Anne celebration, but what they really did not like is the wayward shrine that a village close to me had with Saint Lazarus. And Lazarus from the Bible, this specific Lazarus, was never canonized as a saint. However, on that shrine, it is engraved S. Lazarus. So the people living here said, oh yeah, this is our saint. And they left small coins near that statue in a specific mold and a stone. And they would kind of buy a year of health from that saint, and specifically protection from, I think it was rashes. That's also how kind of Christianity is connected to paganism in many interesting ways, because I believe the Romans, again, did the exact same thing.
It's really interesting to me, especially out of that perspective of, you know, Saint Anne or Saint Mary. Saint Anne specifically, of course, here being, you know, not only not the mother of Jesus, but the grandmother, is quite a step removed, of course. And that with a lot of saints, you have that too, where I almost feel like that's very similar to how you'd have animism go into personification, certain elemental forces that then would be kind of personified to the point of having names and having characteristics, like sort of, you know, thunder being turned into Donna and things like that, right? Like, I almost wonder if that's a little bit of that just being really carried on and just being a little bit of a echo of the past.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of pagan deities, here specifically Germanic deities, got kind of syncretized later with Christian figures. I actually, in my grimoire, I have a list of deities I believe to be synchronized. I'm just quickly looking that up if I can find it. One that I remember at the top of my head is that Wodan probably got syncretized with Saint Michael, because a lot of churches, old churches dedicated to Saint Michael, are in places where old worship centers for Wodan are presumed to have been. What is also suspicious is that the celebration for Saint Michael, it was decreed, I think, by the son of Charlemagne, that this celebration should take place on the same time period as the heathen celebration for Wodan. Mm. And the celebration of Saint Michael being on the 29th of September, I always felt like the heathen celebration for Wodan must have taken place somewhere around the solstice and connected to the harvest in a way. But that's just my theory. By the way, I think in modern Low Saxon language that I speak, his name would be like Vor or Vo, which is kind of, well, a bit random. I don't think that Vor has the same kind of oomph to it as Wodan.
Yeah.
Also, I think that maybe Dona was syncretized with Saint Peter, since there are a lot of traditions with Saint Peter which kind of maybe possibly like back to Dona, especially in connection to spring and specific Thursdays in March, which in Scandinavia and southern Scandinavia still carry the name of Thor's Thursdays. So even in northern Germany, we also have this kind of weird association between the celebration for St. Peter in late February, the Thursdays in March, and Dona, and it's all kind of intermeshed.
Mm. So if I'm going to be presumptuous here, I would say that St. Anne sounds very much like Frau Holle.
Yeah, but the thing is that Frau Holle, as her name is now, probably also wasn't like an ancient deity. I mean, the Germanic tribes probably wouldn't have recognized her under that name.
No.
So the thing that I find interesting is that when it comes to pagan survivals, one route may have been synchronization with Christian figures. Another opportunity might have been to just push them into the realm of folklore, where they were like less disruptive to the Christian systems that were building themselves up. I feel like it's always kind of interesting to compare these two things, to compare how maybe Christian traditions are celebrated locally and how maybe pagan aspects show up in local folklore, and then kind of maybe in a way try to see parallels between these two.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you have to obviously make a case for, and I think this is something that sometimes can be a little bit of a slippery slope when we want to apply terminology on ancient history, because it's just, it doesn't quite work that way. So in the case, for example, with Frau Holle, that's a very modern, well, modern in terms of like, you know, 18th century, let's say, term. And Nerthos, for example, would be maybe like the older name. And then you've probably, and the next thing is every region would have different names or different ways of calling a very similar concept. And then today we would just have one figure that would have traditionally probably encompassed so many different little figures.
The thing that I also find interesting, which always confused me when I first started researching female deities in Germanic paganism, is that they all kind of interconnect and at one point all kind of form this same unanimous undefined blob. Because we have Nerthos on one hand, then we have the goddess Fri or Freya, and she seems to be a deity of central importance to the continental Germanic pantheon. But then in a bit further north, with the North Germanic tribes in southern Scandinavia, this deity likely split up into Freya and Frigg, and became two deities. And then we also have some minor female deities. And if we compare it to folklore, we have minor female spirits in folklore. And my thought process always was like, what Germanic deity might this female folkloric figure originate from? Which is a kind of flawed perspective to take. But that was just what I thought initially. And it always came down to some sort of primordial mother goddess, which might have been Nerthus, which might have been Freya, which might have had a completely different name. But nowadays, I think it's more important to see the immediate cultural ties that these folkloric female figures have to their community. And I also recognize that it's often not that simple, that one thing immediately became the other, and it is more of a transition of different motives and different themes through time, which always kind of reform themselves to the current perceptions and needs of the culture.
Yeah, you always have to take into consideration with people moving around, you're going to have people moving into new environments, and that environment is going to affect their day-to-day life and in terms, and then obviously how they interact with the world and how they also interact with nature and their beliefs. Like, it's this entire process, and like, it's not just, as you said, step one, step two, not at all.
I also often find that on my TikTok, especially in my comments, people always seem to think that the Germanic pantheon was the same all throughout time and space. Yeah. That if they have German ancestry and want to connect to their pagan ancestors, they go for Norse stuff, which I'm like, no, not exactly.
Yeah.
And, people have to recognize that the beliefs of, for example, the Germanic tribe of the Alemanni, which lived in southwestern Germany and near the Swiss Alps, is not going to be the same of, for example, Vikings in late Viking Age Iceland, for example. These groups are related, yes. These groups draw from a similar cultural tradition, yes. But these groups are so far apart in space and time that, of course, their beliefs are going to change. If you are looking now today at different pieces of folklore from different villages and cities, you're going to find vastly different stories from town to town. And why would you think that in the past it was any different?
Yeah.
You know?
And I feel like that is also, in my opinion, an argument to be made, because I know a lot of times when we look at, for example, pagan reconstruction, people are like, oh, we have to do it in this very exact way, or you're not allowed to do this, or you're not allowed to do that, as if people in ancient history, and not even ancient, just, you know, 300 years ago, done exactly that. And we don't, you know, say, oh, that was wrong for them to necessarily do. Like, it just happened. It is what it is. And to a certain degree, you know, we need to, in my opinion, I always see things like that as, If things don't evolve and if things don't adapt, then they're going to become like, you don't have a connection to them anymore. You don't have that relevancy to them anymore. And then they just die out with time, unfortunately, to a certain degree. And so evolution, I do think, especially with folk tales, it can be important. Not always, but, you know, you do have observance of them too, in a way. But I do think that sometimes it's the only way to preserve them, if that makes sense.
It's really interesting the time in history that we're at right now, because the way that folklore is going to evolve now and in the next even like, God, I don't know, like 30 to 50 years in our perception and understanding of that. You know, mm-hmm. we're living in this time of great technological advancement, and the way that we engage with each other is entirely different. I mean, the thing that we're doing literally right now, speaking to a phone that connects us in three different countries at once yeah. so that we can talk about folklore. Like, this is a great step in evolution that can either be excellent for the preservation of folklore or absolutely and completely detrimental. And I think that's kind of how we make it at this point.
Oh yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on specific creators which may or may not have a PhD in folklore studies, which kind of tend to, in a way, bastardize and misrepresent a lot of folklore on social media specifically.
Well, it's just like the cheapening of something. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm about to quote The Secret History, which is a book I read a long time ago and Ella is now reading.
Yeah.
It's better to know, for example, one book very intimately than it is 1,000 superstitiously. That's not the word I meant to use. Superficially or on some kind of shallow level. And I think it's the same when it comes to folklore or any of this kind of anthropological yeah. humanities kind of thing. Like, know what you know intimately. But I think when we have these creators that are like, today I'm going to teach you about XYZ, and it's clear that they have a very superficial understanding of XYZ, and that doesn't have to be like a direct insult to them, you know. Like, you can't actually really expect one person to know the entirety of European folklore. Of course you can't. Unfortunately, like, instead of saying of course you can't, so I'm gonna specialize in something and treat it with respect, we have this very superficial way of speaking about these cultures.
Yeah, and again, it comes down to, you know, quick views, maybe even quick buck, you know, and it's really mm-hmm. important, obviously. I feel like a lot can be said. Maybe that's for another episode. But I almost wonder if the Brother Grimm would have been regarded in a similar fashion.
Mm.
The thing is, they did kind of not portray a lot of the folklore accurately, but in the same time, they actually were experts in their yeah. field.
Yeah.
And I think that is what differentiates them from a lot of modern individuals who kind of interpret folklore and try to teach folklore online, especially, is that they aren't really experts. They maybe have read one Wikipedia article. They maybe have read one blog post from Viking Berserker 350, and then we're like, yes, this is factually accurate.
Exactly.
Misinformation can spread so fast online, and mm-hmm. if you are going to sensationalize it to that degree, it has much more of a higher chance of being spread and believed. And I think this all circles back to the thing that we already talked about of folklore and folk traditions and folk culture being kind of capitalized on, being kind of taken out of their context, misrepresented to gain profit in any way, be that views or money.
When we have certain instances like that, you know, I mean, especially with the Grimm, again, it's something we talked about previously, people don't realize that they were folklorists and professionals and actually used to be at university, like, as professors and whatnot and librarians. And that's the thing, a lot of times we give esteem to certain people online because that's how they present themselves. They present themselves as an authority. And it can be very difficult to kind of, like, there's so many voices to who do you listen to? Who do you start believing? Do you believe anyone at all anymore, you know? And it's getting really oversaturated as well. And I feel like we're going to have a climax of that where I feel like we're going to see some real repercussions. But it is really, really unfortunate when you see something like that happening, when a cultural tradition, for example, gets taken out of that context and made into just a capitalistic sort of, oh, I'm going to, you know, squeeze this out like a lemon. And I mean, you know, something that I have a disclaimer, I'm not sure if you've ever listened to the full episode last time, but I added a little tiny disclaimer being like, we do not present ourselves as authority, because I think that's something that's important to, if you want to talk about these things, in my opinion, it's important to make sure that if you want to share anything, share it with, hey, you know, I'm not an expert, or none of us necessarily experts, at least not in everything. It's an important bit of nuance, and I think sometimes, especially with a short platform, short content platform like TikTok, that can easily get lost.
We, as you said, we are all kind of specialized in our specific tiny niche. And I mean, we all probably feel the same when we try to teach about that specific niche on places like TikTok, on social media in general, where attention spans are getting shorter, content is getting shorter and more snappy. And it's really hard to get all of that nuance in a lot of the time. And if you don't, sometimes if you don't get all of the nuance right, the thing that you produce can almost be kind of misinformation, because there is this gigantic mountain of background information just missing. And I notice that in my content often, where I want to say so much more and I can't, because I can't on TikTok, I can't make longer videos. On YouTube, I have to worry about people's attention spans and how I exactly phrase things. And the thing is, not everyone is necessarily an academic who's used to taking in a lot of information all at once.
I mean, there are certainly people, and I do occasionally enjoy that too. But for the most part, the standard YouTube video is 10 to 15 minutes, not 2-3 hours.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. It's an interesting one, I feel like. But now, even nowadays with books, I mean, again, might be a completely different topic, but book deals are becoming more and more prevalent, where now you even have to be like, oh gosh, I mean, obviously books have never been fully perfect, even in history, as we know. You know, a lot of misinformation being spread through books, not just today, but, you know, 50, 100 years ago as well, or even 300 years ago. It's important to always vet your sources. Make sure they're not just some article and the person who wrote it just used the username professor, doctor, whatever.
I think we should also pay attention to who is getting those book deals. Who are the people who are being brought out as experts? Are their credentials right? But also, if you want to learn maybe about German folk magic, Danish folk magic, whatever, and you see a book on that specific part of folk magic, and you see it's written by an American who just lived their entire life in America, for example, at least be a bit wary about the information that's going to be in there. Because, of course, you can read a lot of books, you can read a lot of articles, but some things are just going to be lost in translation if you're not growing up or actively living in that culture. And the sad truth is that many people don't care about that. I'm about to say something controversial again, but sometimes I have the feeling that when it comes to America, which is, I think, where a large chunk of all of our audience comes from, I feel like many of them, when they want to learn about a European branch of folk magic, they ask another American.
Yeah.
Because they kind of feel, I don't know what they think, maybe it's something of like, maybe they are already familiar, they are already of my country, of my culture, let's ask them. And people from Europe might seem very distant and foreign to them. But the thing is, if you really want to learn about this stuff, eventually you're going to have to make contact with the people that you want to learn about.
And surely it's about the people, right? Because when we're talking about folklore and these like very small microcosms of culture, they can't exist without the people. They don't exist without the people. So you need to be able to actually connect with them, not someone, you know, thousands of miles away who has maybe been there on holiday. Speak to someone who's been there for their entire lives or for generations, you know?
Yeah.
And this kind of goes into like armchair anthropology. There's only so much that you can learn through books and websites. If you really want to get down to the meaty bits of it, I think you should do some field work, as we would say, right? And actually go to the place and actually, I know that in anthropology, I'm not sure if you always, if you said the same thing. In my course, they always said, if you want to get to know a culture, you need to do field work for at least 2-3 years to really finally even open up fully to the people.
I think for us, it can be pretty frustrating when, of course, we in our countries reach a limited number of people. And then we see someone over in the US doing videos on our specific niche and getting so much stuff wrong. and reaching so many people, and then you can be like, just no.
Yeah, especially when you then correct them and then they just block you on Twitter and Instagram and everything.
Yeah, for example.
It's one of those things that's going to take time, because I feel like now that the interest is there for ancestral kind of practices, I think we've got a rocky road ahead of us, and it's going to not be a smooth sailing at all, but we'll get there eventually, I'm sure of it. It's just going to take some time, patience, and making sure we understand how we communicate with each other a lot of times too. Like, we communicate very differently, I think.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been really great to talk to you, and you've offered some really insightful pieces of information that I'm sure the audience is just as happy as we are to have received. Are there any social media places or anything at all that you'd like to promote just now?
Everything's basically in my link tree. Like, if you go on one of my social media and see the link tree, then you can just find me everywhere else. But I think I'll take this opportunity then to promote some other creators that I think deserve a spotlight, especially a Hearthwitch on TikTok, also Nordic Animism on YouTube. And also I recently discovered the Polish Folk Witch on Instagram. She's also from Silesia. So that's really cool, especially for me with my Silesian ancestry. So if you are interested in Polish folk magic or Silesian folk magic in particular, give her a follow. I don't think that you'll regret it.
I just followed her too. If anyone has any kind of questions, you are able to send in any questions, I think, either here on whichever platform you're listening to, or of course in our email. If you have a story to share, again, always feel free to email that to us. We love having on people, or we would love to have people on, even if you don't have a social media account or anything at all, and you're just kind of like stumbling upon this and you've got a story to tell. Anything and everything is going to be in the bio, so you know, all the socials and everything like that.
See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
're purely discussing topics for the sake of entertainment. We do not present ourselves as authorities on the topics discussed. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at your own risk. This podcast should not be considered professional advice. Unless specifically stated otherwise, a German folk witchery, Downholiswell, does not endorse, approve, recommend, or certify any information, product, process, service, or organization presented or mentioned in this podcast. And information from this podcast should not be referenced in any way to imply such approval or endorsement.